We looked at two places in Papua New Guinea. One was a bright spot, and that was on Karkar Island, and the other one was what we could call an average spot. It performed exactly as expected by our model, given the conditions it was exposed to. And you know, one of the big differences is when I started working in these two sites, they both had these traditional or customary management institutions where they would place a tambu, or what we would call a taboo, on an area of reef, and no one was allowed to go fishing there. And, you know, this didn't have National Park Service patrol boats or anything. These were customary practices that the locals would put on. And they were often done for sort of for social events, you know, if somebody would pass away, or if they noticed that the fish were getting too difficult to catch or were swimming too far away, they would put these tambus on. And, you know, one of the big differences is the place that performed exactly as expected has lost this over the years. We've been back, you know, over the course of these 15 years. And at this point in time, you know, basically it's very poorly complied with, and there's doubt in the community as to whether it actually even exists or not. Some people say there's still a tambu there, but it's just that nobody complies with it, and other people say that that's not there at all. Now, in the bright spot, you know, the three clans have come together and decided to, again, tambu a big area of reef. And in fact, it's their entire fishing ground for the community of their reef area. Now, some people can still go offshore and fish beyond the reef, but their entire reef is closed to fishing, and it's been about 2 years, and, you know, they don't really set dates. They don't really do these things by calendars, but it's likely to be another year or two.
Michelle, as a sociologist, you were looking at the communication side of things. What did you find in the communities around the coral bright spot that were absent in the average location?
One thing I did really notice just spending time there is that people tended to cluster by clans in both places that we were in. And, you know, in Aarhus, which was the average spot where the institutional system had kind of degraded over time, which Josh was speaking about, there wasn't a lot of communication between clans, but also even just among fishers in general. And I think that might have a lot to do with why people are so confused about whether there even is a tambu, you know, if it's being complied with or not, you know, what are the rules even? If people aren't communicating, they're going to be pretty lost as to what's supposed to be going on and what rules they're supposed to be complying with. Also, you know, it's not going to help people come together to cooperate because the different clans, they own different parts of the sea. And so, you know, in order to really effectively manage the system, they kind of have to work together in order to, you know, in order to kind of create sustainable fisheries over time. And they're not able to do that if they're not communicating. You know, and we can kind of contrast this a bit, too, with the bright spot that we worked in. You know, in one of the villages in Karkar, where all clans had come together to cooperatively create a really large fisheries closure. And, you know, this wouldn't have been possible without channels of communication and trust that exist between the different clans.
Mentioning trust in particular, I'd imagine that was there any kind of tension about people being able to access enough fish to be able to live, to be able to, you know, sell if they are selling them? I mean, I imagine that that would take a huge level of trust because otherwise people are just going to, you know, not conform to the tambu, right?
Right, yeah. No, I completely agree. And I think in Aarhus there was, which was, again, the average spot, there was a bit more hesitation about that. And a lot of people had talked about, you know, this kind of understanding or this perception that population had grown a lot, and so maybe they wouldn't be able to provide. And in Aarhus, they actually don't have access to agricultural land, so that makes it a bit harder. Whereas in, you know, in Karkar, they do have access to agricultural land, but also people, you know, fish outside the reef as well. So they're able to kind of adapt strategies a bit here and there when fisheries closures are created. So I think that you know, definitely plays a role in some senses as well.
Josh, where to now? What else do you need to look at to build a picture of what's going on here?
We've still got people in the field now. One of my PhD students, Jackie Lau, is also looking at how different types of institutions allow people to get different types of access to ecosystem services. And, you know, one of the ideas that we have in this is that maybe the, you know, the bright spots, which are defined by having more fish than expected, given the conditions they're exposed to, they might be bright ecologically, but, you know, maybe dark socially. It may be that institutions prevent certain segments of the society from accessing the resources. So we've got people pursuing a whole range. We've actually got a whole team of researchers up there. So it's just, you know, it's a very diverse project approaching this from a lot of different angles. You know, we've got sociologists and development scholars and geographers and ecologists working on the problem.